These are the Target Files, taking a 21st century look back at the 20th century adventures of the Doctor in novelization and audiobook form, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, there's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time. Hello, welcome to Doctor Who Target Files. This is Mike in Swansea, and this time we are discussing for episode 61, The Brain of Morbius, novelised by Terence Dix, and the audiobook performed by the great Tom Baker.
Indeed. Hello, this is Alex in a very snowy Exeter.
Yes, not so much snow, just a little bit of a sprinkling down here in the South Wales coast, but West Country-wise and down with you, Al, it's Devon-wise, it's a little bit thicker, isn't it?
It's a lot thicker and makes you think a lot because, you know, the Brain of Morbius is always on a sort of stormy sort of planet. So what do you think of it?
Very thoroughly enjoyable, Al, audiobook-wise, novelisation-wise, and the TV story. Excellent effort, really. I was looking into the history of this, a documentary which I'll have to remember the name of on the DVD release from about a decade ago. Tells us the slightly troubled nature of getting this story to the screen. There was a bit of a argument between Terence Dix and Robert Holmes at the time about over rewrites, and it ended up going out on the screen under the pseudonym of Robin Bland, which Terence Dix tells the story about. He had some rewrites done by Robert Holmes which removed the element of a robot, which became the character Kondo. Terence Dix's original work had sent this out as a robot, but Robert Holmes changed it to the character of Kondo. They ended up having a bit of a furious argument over the phone, where Terence Dix signed off by saying, "You can put this out under any sort of Bland surname, take my name off it." So Robert Holmes took that literally, and we ended up with Robin Bland.
Well, it's very interesting, because I think, the Kondo character works better than the robot, probably, but it's just interesting because it's one of Robert Holmes and Philip Hinchcliffe's best series, I think.
Yes, in that period, isn't it, of a lot of gothic horror. Within this story, we have the almost sort of practicality of technology up against the mysticism of the Sisterhood of Khan, I've written down.
Yeah, definitely, you've got that technological versus, sort of historical, not liking. It's the whole magic science debate, really, with the Sisters of Khan, who are brilliantly performed in the TV episode and done well in the book, and that led down the Doctor Who future. We had them again recently with the whole McGann changing into the War Doctor. They were very important recently, and it's just really interesting how the technological comes over. It has that Frankenstein outlook. I think this whole book is slightly based on Frankenstein, I think, like Mary Shelley.
Yeah, so we looked into it more, the return of the Khan Sisterhood in the 50th anniversary year, Day of the Doctor special, regeneration for Paul's Doctor into John Hurt, the War Doctor. Character of Ohika, isn't there, in this book, and then we have Ohila, played by, what's the actress's name, Claire something?
Oh, I know what you mean, yeah, I know what you mean. She's been in lots of things, and it's sort of quite similar, I think.
And she was in Hellraiser as well, wasn't she? Let us know, folks, at DW Target Files.
Definitely, she was definitely one of the main actresses in that fantastic Clive Barker film, Hellraiser, and she's really good. But I think it's good how they've connected those characters over the years and get their first great performance in this book, and they're sort of on that lovely planet of Khan, what is so well described in the book, and how it's a junkyard planet, basically, and the Doctor doesn't really want to be there.
Yes, reminded me elements as well of The Doctor's Wife in the Matt Smith era, where they ended up the crew of the TARDIS on a junkyard planet, didn't they?
Oh yeah, definitely. There's that thing about that connection that it sort of has been, those elements have been used, and it's sort of very sort of nasty sort of looking planet. And then you get this sort of gothic splendorness of the palace and everything, what, you know, they're all living in. I think it works so well, personally.
Yes, we spoke last time about how the Target books can add scope and scale, and they certainly do in this story. It's an excellent TV story, very dimly lit, superb performances, but a very tight sort of story, and Terrence Dix has really gone to add the epicness to this, as Tom has managed as well in the audiobook.
Oh, definitely. It's a really great performance by Tom Baker in the audiobook, and it sort of adds all these sort of bits what you didn't really have time for in the TV episode. So I still think the TV episodes are really great, because they're shot so moodily and dark, I think, for the first couple of episodes.
And I think we talk about the sound design on these books, the soundscape. I think Simon Power was the editor as far back as, I think this one's been out about 10 years now, 2008. But, you know, he's gone to painstaking detail just to add little flourishes, like the echoing nature of Morbius's voice, and that adds so much, doesn't it, to the grandeur of being in this wide open space of a castle, as perhaps doesn't get recognised as much in the confines of a TV studio.
Oh, definitely. It's just those little sound elements, like, as you said, Morbius's voice, you know, when he's sitting in the fist tank, and sort of little echoey bits and the lightning and thunder and sort of mood bits really add to the sort of performance of Tom.
And what do you think it is all these years? We've seen it through TV and now audiobooks, various performances. Lucky enough to see the guy at a few conventions. What is it about Tom's voice, do you think, that captures just something that keeps your attention, doesn't it? Is something such a skill he has?
I just think it just gets better. It's got better and better over the years. And, you know, Tom's voice has always been, you know, when he's done other audiobooks I've listened to, it haven't been sort of Doctor Who. His voice is so sort of engaging and sort of keeps you listening, and it's sort of very sort of in control. And it's, I think in the last couple of years when he's been working with Big Finish, it's just got even better, I think.
And, you know, could he perhaps read the phone book and keep it interesting? I'd want to try that one out, I think.
I think he's one of those people, like, you know, like I say, like Penelope Cruz could do. I think he is one of those people who could read anything and it would be interesting.
And thankfully, you know, given his age, I think he was 84 back in January, and the voice is there, isn't it? It's been such a huge part of his charisma and character and career. Thankfully, it's still there with him, you know, in the modern Big Finish adaptations of Fourth Doctor stories.
Oh, definitely. I think the voice is still beautifully there. You know, I've been listening to a couple of the first ones he did for Big Finish, and it's so there. I mean, you know, it's the Fourth Doctor, and he's just brings so much to it for his voice. And it's like, I'm glad Big Finish are doing as much as possible, you know, because of the whole age factor. His voice, you'd never know that. And he's so typically Tom's doing at the age of 84, really.
But is one consequence of him taking so long to be persuaded by Big Finish that he hasn't tended to do any of these Target novelisations since this and the Pyramids of Mars, I think?
It's a bit of a shame, because we could have got more of him doing Doctor Who. I think he did Robot as well, but I think he just didn't want to do it, and then it took the Big Finish showing how much people love him still, basically, as the Fourth Doctor, and that spurred him on now, I think. And even the sort of nutty thing he does with Babbage Productions, Baker's End, which is fantastic. It's just him being him, really.
Yes, haven't they got Colin Baker doing that as well now?
Yeah, I think so. The new one I haven't heard yet has got Colin Baker as well involved. And it's just nuts. It's basically, if you haven't heard of people, it's a mad parody of Tom Baker being Tom, basically, with mad actors and actresses, you know, around him. It is hilarious.
Yes, from what I've read and heard from other people, it seems to be sort of Tom's version in his head of what the world's like.
Oh yes, definitely, and he's hilarious. I do recommend any of the Babish and Baker's End productions. They are fantastic.
Anyway, back to the characters within the brain of Morbius. Al, what did you make, well, throwing it in altogether really, what did you make of Tom's take on the Solon character, really memorably played by Philip Maddock in the TV version?
I think he still has some of the importance of the, you know, of the Solomon character, but when Tom does it, but I think Philip Maddock has made it so much his own. Well, it is better on TV. Right? I think that Tom does get the idea of his importance and his sort of, you know, I'm trying to rebuild this character until, you know, it's Morbius, who, you know, the Doctor's completely against coming back. It's sort of, he's sort of with him a bit, I think, the first bit.
I mean, do we give Tom a bit of a free rein, perhaps, at times to go over the top with these characters, because it's Tom, generally? As, you know, it...
Yeah, probably a little bit. I do, like, you know, I think this could be raining a bit. I think, oh, it's Tom's, I don't really mind. That's how I look at it, really.
Yeah, and I suppose when you consider it's Philip Maddock, who had a very almost Richard Burton-esque sort of deep Welsh voice, Tom's given it something a little bit extra in the book as well, hasn't he? That's a huge skill in itself as an actor.
Oh, definitely, because the Philip Maddock, you know, in the actual TV thing is fantastic, but I really like the Tom one because he gives it slightly more manicness and slightly more, you know, he wants to put more of his back together and it's not possible, and he's getting more manic and manic by the end. I think Tom does that so well.
Slightly more sort of, I describe it, devilishly camp, isn't it, with Tom?
It's very camp. The sort of, by the end, it's sort of more manically camp by the minute base when he's not able, you know, and he's not able to put the body together and it's not going well for him. It's sort of very over the top, but it's pretty brilliant, I think.
Yes, very campile.
Did you go to the regen when he was there? Because I think I missed that by a year.
I think that was a year before he sadly passed away, Philip Maddock. It was a wonderful one. And actually, yeah, I think Regenerations, when they didn't have the full weekend convention one year, did a screening of this story around about 10 years ago. Let us know if you were there here in South Wales, folks, with Philip Maddock present. And the what Carrie Woodward, the organiser, always used to have at Regenerations was the actual Morbius brain itself, wasn't it? The prop which we also saw at the Doctor Who Experience.
Oh, yeah, he did in that wonderful prop they use. You know, sort of looks like a fish tank, but it's sort of great little thing.
Yes, indeed, Al. And I'm just looking at the layers of characters, in particular Solon and Kondo. Kondo is more or less the slave of Solon, but we seem to get a little bit of sympathy, I think, for Solon later on, as he is obviously the puppet of Morbius.
I think there's sympathy for both those characters, because he's definitely the puppet of Morbius, definitely. He does whatever Morbius tells him. I think Conan is the puppet of Solomon. He's sort of the slave who he thinks is an idiot, but by the end is actually sort of made to be quite an important character, I think.
And thinking of the actors' names, forgive us being bad fanboys, folks, but I watched a documentary on the DVD, and this was actually the actor playing Kondo, his first role out of drama school, and I thought he was absolutely fantastic in the TV version.
Oh, he's really, because it's not a lot of talking, it's more motion acting, and he's fantastic.
Absolutely brilliant, that whole sort of relationship with Sarah, that's very Frankenstein-esque, isn't it, the bride. And
bits from King Kong, I think, come in there, the way he is with her.
Yeah, that human, particularly human-female relationship.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think the Sarah Jane role in this book is quite interesting, because it sort of could be seen as her not being her sort of most great character. I think it's quite good, though, the way the whole blind bit and the whole not getting too screamy.
Possibly sidelined a little bit in this story. There's quite a lot of other strong female characters in the Sisterhood in particular.
Yeah, possibly. I think because, you know, as we say, there's more strong characters in the Sisterhood. They're sort of main female characters, and she's sort of sidelined by being A, not there a lot, or being blind and feeling around the castle sort of stuff. Which I think still really good for what she gets.
Yes, and the whole mysticism of the Sisterhood, the idea of the elixir, or the elixir, as Tom likes to call it.
Yeah, it's interesting, this whole sort of myth versus science there again. And I did have that lovely joke right at the end where he fixes the flame of the elixir because it's all got sooted up. That's a great little line, I think, for Tom there.
Yeah, and apparently Tom nearly got set on fire on during that filming scene.
I'm not surprised, because it sort of does that last scene where it sort of whoops up because it's sort of being blocked. I'm not surprised.
No such thing as elfin safety in those days, folks.
No. You can stand by lit like Tom.
Blue Peter here in the UK used to have John Noakes climbing up Nelson's column with one normal rope attached. So
I know. You get these days, and the whole
famous kids TV show.
The whole, you know, some others to Abbott stunts you'd never get these days.
But I watched a YouTube video of some kids, sort of early adulthood kids walking over the Severn Bridge on the main beam last Sunday morning here in the UK. So
it's still there.
Mildly impressed by them doing it, but not by the fact that the emergency services would have had to
yes,
deal with remains and things if it had gone spectacularly wrong, but you know, I suppose really, thankfully in one way, they got it right.
It's not many characters, but the characters you get are really cleverly done, and you know, are main characters. But I do agree, what the Doctor has more than Sarah does in this book, I think.
And do you know something about the Sisterhood? Do the scenes with them drag a little? They tend to be a little bit boring compared to the scenes with Solon and Sarah and Kondo and the Doctor.
I think they can a little bit, because they're just sort of quite dry, getting over the religious point of Khan and how, you know, the Sisterhood's been there for years. But I think because they had really good actresses doing it at the time, it works, I think. Well, I agree, in the book, these scenes can be a bit long, where the scenes with, you know, Solomon and Kondo and Doctor and Sarah are really full-paced action stuff, really.
Turning that on its head the other way around, there's one specific scene when the Doctor and Sarah first arrive to Solon. Philip Maddox sells it really well, the look he gives Tom Baker, you know, and he takes in a great admiration of his head, and there's a great reference back to the John Pertwee Doctor and the Grey Hair, the Grey Model, Tom calls him. I think that loses a little bit in the book.
Yeah, a little bit. I think it works better on the episode when you see what Philip Maddox is sizing his head up, basically. It's a very nasty little quick scene. I think it's definitely better in the episode than the book, I think.
And how did you feel about the ending as a whole, Al?
I think the ending's really good. I think, you know, you do unfortunately get rid of Morbius, and you get, sorry, spoiler there, and you know, all the big characters sort of end up with sort of quite good endings, and you know, the way the Doctor sorts out the Sisters of Khan's problem. But it's very interesting to see how it's obviously a character people like, because, you know, Morbius has come back in Big Finish, and the Sisters of Khan have come back in Big Finish, and on, you know, and on the main TV. So they're obviously characters that made a good impression at the time, basically, and are still well liked.
Was it Sisters of the Flame and Revenge of Morbius for Big Finish with Paul McGann?
It is indeed. Those are the two titles for it. And
that's a Lucy Miller series, isn't it, with Sheridan Smith, I think.
Morbius in Big Finish Land is, gone out of my head, Sam West.
Oh, brilliant. Of course, Timothy's son.
Yeah, Sam West is who they gave Morbius to in Big Finish Land. That's a very good episode. I've got that.
Also in Diary of River Song, of course, the first season. Very good.
Yeah, very good, very good. All very good things to get from Big Finish.
So, Al, shall we talk about the covers for this one?
Let's do, yes. Okie dokie.
We have the initial release, 23rd of June, 1977. Not an artist I've seen before on the books we've covered thus far, Mike Little. Orange background, black lettering on the sort of Baker-era logo over an orange background. A big picture of Tom with looking like he's rather orange suntanned, like a lot of people have in Swansea these days. With a side profile of Philip Maddox, with a side profile of the Brain. That's a pretty interesting one. And we also had a Mike Little cover where the orange background was taken down to a yellow, which seems to work pretty well as well. That was 1978 edition. And then Alistair Pearson got in on the game as well in 1991. The sort of strange ribbon effect they have with the Starfield background of the Sylvester McCoy logo. Then the Brain of Morbius, white lettering, based on a Doctor Who adventure first broadcast in 1976. A various collage element of the Doctor standing tall over Morbius. A slightly sort of more photorealistic rendition of Philip Maddox and Sarah Jane amongst a sort of black swooping background. That's quite a good one. I think I'd have these two as pretty evens, Al. I think Mike Little in 1970s and Alistair Pearson in 1991. Both good efforts.
Yeah, they sound the nicer ones. I think the first one's a bit too orange, but the second one, and definitely Alistair Pearson, sound very nice. They look like they get the whole feel of the Morbius over.
Designed for a junior Doctor Who in the Brain of Morbius, Terence Dick's book, which was brought out for the youngsters, aimed at the younger readers, and was one of two such experiments with Doctor Who, or junior Doctor Who, and the giant robot, I think, Al. That's a much larger picture of Tom with Solon wrestling with the head of Morbius. That's a pretty striking one as well.
That's rather nice.
Yeah, it's definitely got Tom on the cover. You're sold with the image of the Doctor and a nice blend of Doctor Who with a yellow logo and the junior part in a sort of orange-red motif. So that's a pretty good one again.
Yeah, nice sort of cover. I think any of those three are quite nice.
And then they think they reproduced it for this CD release around about 2008 with the orange background again. That's a good transfer of the original Mike Little cover.
That looks better on the CD box than the original book cover, then.
I think it does, with a stretched sort of element. I think it.
Oh, yeah.
I think I do prefer it on the CD cover. So, Al, shall we wrap up our closing thoughts and scores on The Brain of Morbius?
Indeed. I think it's a really well-written book. It has lots of action. It has good aspects of, you know, getting you to think about, you know, mysticism versus sort of creatism. And it's really well-written. I really like the episodes as well. I think the TV episodes are very well-paced. There's some brilliant acting from Tom, Philip Maddock, and the women who play the Sisters of Khan are fantastic. I enjoyed the audiobook. I think Tom is brilliant when he gets going on good audiobook. Wish he'd done more. So I'd probably give the book a 7, and the audiobook and the TV episodes probably an 8.5, I think.
Thoroughly enjoyable one, again. Tom Baker, absolutely superb. Brilliantly sells this story. As we said, something about his voice just keeps you captivated. It'd be interesting to hear him on perhaps some not-so-popular Target adaptations within the audiobook range. I would say 7.58 for the book. And I think you've got to add for the TV version another point, 8.5, and you've got to add another whole point for Tom's performance, really, because it's Tom, and that's going to be a whopping 9.5 from me for the audiobook.
Really? Well, I do agree. Well, I'm just a bit more, you know, I think it's brilliant. I probably should have gone to a 9 for Tom's performance, because it is brilliant. The audiobook is just rather fun from start to finish.
Excellent, Tom. Excellent. And one thing we haven't discussed, a bit of controversy, Al, within the book, the whole idea of the 12 regeneration limit being set in this one, which set off fandom down the years. Terrence Dick says in the documentary on the DVD, the making of documentary, that fans made a huge issue out of this. There was actually an interesting story where they had used people such as Chris Barry, the director, dressed up as the various pictures of other Doctor incarnations we see on the screen, and they got told off by Equity, who were saying the actors weren't paid for this, and they had to explain that it was actually those members of the production team dressed up in the background, and they had to make a payment to the actors' benevolent fund as a sort of compromise.
Gone past the 12 theory, you know, when we got to Matt Smith regenerating to Peter, didn't we? We had that whole, you know, well, how can they go further when it's up to 12 regens there? And it's sort of being sort of covered with the way we managed to cover it. But, yeah, I can see why there would have been problems back then, because, you know, 12 would have probably seemed like a limitation, or, you know, where it couldn't go any further. And, you know, Tom was probably thinking back then where he was going to be there forever, which he was, you know, until he got bored with it, unfortunately.
It would be interesting to see whether Stephen Moffat was the one who wanted to get round this, or he felt he had to once he'd written the War Doctor, of course, who was another numbered incarnation who they obviously try and forget in that story.
Well, it's an interesting one, because, you know, it depends where you put the War Doctor, because some people call it 9.5, don't they? So it still sort of comes under the 12 regeneration rule. Well, I think, you know, like you said, I think Stephen Moffat got to that bit of the War Doctor and think, well, how do I get past the 12 regeneration thing, and came up with that great way he did get around it.
I'm just thinking of the first Doctor adventures that Big Finish have recently done. Haven't they introduced James Dreyfus as an earlier master than Delgado? So we're not sure how many of those there's been.
Yeah, I think they have done those. I haven't actually listened to those yet. But they have introduced a younger master, basically. So they're actually changing slight things there. And I know there's feelings that Big Finish want to also introduce maybe a younger Lethbridge Stewart, or get around the whole Lethbridge Stewart thing, and that's becoming a problem, I think, for them.
Or have Mr. Gatiss as his grandfather again.
That would be a very good... I think that's what might happen, considering now that he's not doing anything more for the main Doctor Who range.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is Alex with Hughes News on the 3rd of March. Now, first thing we need to discuss is the untimely death of Peter Miles. He was in such really great episodes from the Third Doctor as the Invasion of the Dinosaurs, and also did many different works for Big Finish. He will be mainly remembered for his great role as Nida in Genesis of the Daleks, and also for his stage role of the Trial of Davros. Fantastic stuff, and should be well remembered as he had great scenes with Tom Baker in Genesis. We have got some more information about the new series of Doctor Who due to photos from different filmings that have been released, some from Portsmouth and some recently from Monmouth in Wales. It seems to be going very well, but the BBC also seem to be trying to freeze Jodie Whittaker as she's been filming in some of the worst weather we've had in England. We also have the new Doctor Who Target novelisations of 21st Century Doctor Who episodes. They are coming out on the 5th of April, available from all good bookshops. And if you're also interested, there is a signing at Forbidden Planet in London on that date. They will also be coming out as audiobooks in June. So far, we know that the first two will be out and read by Camille Cuddiori, who, of course, is Rose's mum. The two that are coming out as audiobooks in June are Rose by Russell T. Davis and The Christmas Invasion by Jenny Colgan. BigFinish.com have finally brought out their new Gallifrey Time War box set. Four completely new stories in one box set, all involving great characters from the Gallifrey series, such as President, Romana, Leela, Braxitel, and other great characters from that period, also including the War Master, played by Sir Derek Jacobi. Big Finish have also announced that in May, their own version of Star Cops is coming out, originally conceived by Chris Boucher, one of the people who came up with Blake 7, and also the Doctor Who Robots of Death. So, Mike, what other things except Doctor Who world have you been listening and watching?
Well, I finally got to a rewatch season 4, the very famous cliffhanger it was supposed to be at the time in the 80s, but it's never come back since. Blake 7, the famous last episode, Blake, which saw the return of Gareth Thomas as a hardened version of the Rog Blake character who gave name to the series. Very excellent ending again, Al. Really glad it's sort of left on that cliffhanger. I noticed there's been various novelizations and Big Finish prequels and stories set within the timeline within that period. And I think it's something perhaps I would like to see rebooted one day, but stands alone very well, four series back from 1978 to 81. And we're going to get a reissued DVD release, aren't we, in the next month or so?
Yeah, we are. This is planned. But have you ever seen the one where they did reboot Blake 7?
No, they did a visual version, was it?
Yeah, it was about a year or two ago. They did it. It had Daniel Nardini as Servalen.
Wow, so was that...
It was on Channel 5 about 3-4 years ago, I think. Just before Big Finish got the rights to it. And it's very... I thought it wasn't too bad. It's sort of quite modern, dark, really. It had had a really good American actor as Blake, and it had Daniel Ardina as Servalan, basically. And it was very good.
Oh, wow, I'm going to have to try and track that one down, I think, folks. It doesn't seem to get mentioned when I Google it, but...
I think it didn't go down very well with Blake fans, really, because it was quite American. It was not sort of keeping to the original idea, I don't think. Well, I thought it was quite good.
Ah, there we go, Alan. Speaking of 40th anniversaries, I think March the 8th sees the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy radio series have that landmark, and they're presenting a new version on Radio 4 with some of the original cast, aren't they?
They are indeed. It starts next Thursday. It's 6:30, and it looks and sounds fantastic. I will be listening to that. I think it's called the Pandanic Era, I think they're calling it.
And is this another one following on from the one they did just over a decade ago now, where they've got some of Douglas Adams' old written scenes with a new version by another author?
I believe it's not that one, but it's the one where Aaron Colford did a year or two ago called Thanks for All the Fish, basically. The really good Irish child writer Aaron Colford did, and it's sort of, I think it's taken from that. It's got all the original cast in except Stephen Moore, who's basically retired from acting. So it's not it's somebody doing Marvin's voice differently. It was meant to be really good still. What have I been watching this week? I binge watched the Trauma thing, which was the Adrian Lester John Sims drama, because it was like something you couldn't sort of watch daily, you had to watch it all in one go.
Yes, John Sim been in two things recently, hasn't he? That and the Collateral show.
Oh yeah, and Collateral was absolutely excellent. I mean, watching that is sort of, you know, you can't move for really good actors, and you know, good old Big Finish actors and Doctor Who actors with old Billy Piper being fantastic and Nicola Walker being brilliant in it. And what was I was listening to the new Tracy Thorn album this afternoon, which is the woman with Everything But the Girl. Has got a brand new album, which is really good. What have we been watching on? Watching Gotham season 3 on Netflix.
How is that? I've not gone into that yet. I know we have Sean Pertwee, of course, as Alfred the Butler, John's son from Doctor Who fame.
Gotham is really excellent. It's very sort of dark, and it's got the great Sean Pertwee being. Bruce Wayne's butler, and he's fantastic. And it's sort of slowly building up to Bruce turning to Batman, basically. And it's sort of very good, well worth a watch. And finally got audio description with season 3, so I'm a little bit behind on that. But it's very good.
Michelle Gomez, Missy herself, appear in a few episodes of that?
Yeah, I think not in the season 3. I mean, I've noticed that she was in like season 2, I think, as this sort of very good character. Because he has been in that, and of course he's got a new job in Sabrina the Witch, hasn't he?
Yes, that's going to be a Netflix production, I think, Al, so we shall be able to binge watch that on the day it's released, I think.
Ultra Carbon, trying to finish. Star Trek Discovery, I've nearly finished, so that's very good. Looking forward to Jessica Jones on the 8th of March, that's going to be very good.
Yes, I've sort of binge-watched up to episode 10, The Orville, now. I think it's absolutely superb. Seth MacFarlane's Star Trek, I would call it a parody effort, but as the series goes on, there's sort of less jokes, and it really has taken on a Next Generation vibe.
Oh, really? I'll have to look at that, because I think Seth MacFarlane's fantastic what he did. I watched the very creepy Panorama documentary on the Weinsteins last night, which was quite interesting. Oh, that's the other thing I watched this week, the shooting of Johnny Versace, that was very good.
Oh, the follow-up from the trial of O.J. Simpson, the American crime story series.
Yeah, I didn't really see all that. I heard that was very good. I know you enjoyed it. And I watched the, got really good reviews, the shooting of Johnny Versace, and it was really, really well done, I think.
And since our last episode, Al, the new Doctor Who logo been announced at the showcase for BBC Worldwide in Liverpool. What did you make of the little teaser we got?
I know it's been a bit of a Marmite thing the logo has, because it's very bright. I think it's yellow and orange, isn't it, the colours of the logo?
Yes, and it was lovely to see Jodie down in Gosport in Hampshire with fans. She actually, people have noticed online, she approached a lovely young gentleman with Down syndrome, and he was asking her lots of Doctor Who related questions. And one of the questions on the little video that a member of his family got was, do you have a companion? What's your companion's name? And Jodie actually let slip, oh, I have two. So that's something we've had sort of confirmed now, well, by the fantastic lady herself.
She's just brilliant. She seems to get on really well with fans and that. I know people are going to have moaned slightly about the new logo. Oh, it's too bright. I think it works really well. I think we need a bit more brightness, because though Peter was great, it was quite dark, is it? I think the brightness thing's good. What do you think of the? Have you seen any of the photos of the new TARDIS?
Yes, I quite like it. The old St. John's Ambulance logo is gone, I think, which sort of really came in the non-canonical folks, Peter Cushing movies in the 60s, and then brought in for the Matt Smith era.
Yeah, it seems to have gone back. But have they changed the colour of the TARDIS? Because it seems to be more black than blue, the outsides of it.
It's reminiscent, a little less shiny than the Smith and then Capaldi one was. It's down to the more sort of battered look we had of the Tennant era and the Eccleston era. And they've actually, the actual plate outside where they had the do not open outwards or warning sign has changed from white to black. But I think it fits in, you know, fairly well. Be interesting to see. Nobody's spotted anything to do with the interior yet, and we're all looking forward to that.
Oh, definitely. It's just like, you know, now we've also got that little, because it had October on the sort of stuff from the BBC Live thing. Do you think that's the actual date now, or is that just because of the American, is that the American date, I wonder?
Yes, people have speculated whether that will give us a 10-week run into Christmas, and possibly Christmas special will now become the finale. But others have speculated that won't be the case, but there won't be much of a gap, as there was with Series 9, really, between the final episode and the Christmas special, if that's the case. As we understand it, the Christmas special is still going to happen, folks.
Well, what they've worked out, if it's the Christmas special included, it will start on October the 27th, is what they're saying. But I quite like a Christmas special. I think it works well to have that sort of... There won't be much of a gap if it's there, but I think there's room for a Christmas special as well.
Yeah, you know, into March now, still 7 months away, but... I hope in a way they do just drip feed us and they don't give us a trailer too long beforehand, so we haven't got a too long of a wait. But we seem to cope all right with a wait between, was it Doctor Mysterio, wasn't it, and then Series 8 last year?
Yeah, there was quite a bit of a wait between that lovely Christmas episode and the new series. But I think we're probably going to get a trailer in between Wimbledon or the FA Cup, I reckon.
Podcast from the States or Canada speculating the other week that we might get something for San Diego Comic Con, and then we might get something for New York Comic Con, because that takes place in October.
It's just like, hang on, why did the Americans get the stuff for us? Didn't we make Doctor Who? It should all be at our Comic Cons, really.
It's happened, folks, hasn't it, since the Five Doctors. And I know that London Comic Con have announced Peter Capaldi now, and he will be doing a photo shoot with Pearl Mackey on the day. Quite an expensive one, though, Al, but we shall see.
We shall see, definitely. You know, I'm still tempted by it, but it's you know, because you take, you know, 70, we'll say it's £75. People, let us know what you think of that. It's £75 for the photo, and then is it another £75 for the autograph as well?
I think so. It may be down to £60 for the auto.
It's just madness, you think about it. And so you've been to Comic Cons. Is the photo as good as the ones I've got from other things?
It's not as big, Al. It'll be more sort of a... I try and think of the sizes now, more like A5 sized, really.
A5 or 75.
We've had a good A4,
personally,
A5, haven't we?
Personally, I wouldn't
A3
go with that.
We've had.
It's very tempting, even though, because I'd love one with Peter Capaldi. It's like, I was thinking of that, plus the guy from Aquaman from Comic Con. I was just thinking, that's nearly £200.
Yeah, Sam, for me, it's Battlestar Galactica stars are there as well, from the rebooted series from the early to mid-noughties.
Yeah, so your expense would be even more than mine, because mine would just be at the guy from Aquaman and Peter Capaldi.
So we shall have to find some of these events to go to this year, Al. Shall we try and make an effort to go to, is it Pandorica in Bristol?
Yeah, I think we should. I think we should, definitely. I can't remember why we didn't make it last year. It was just sort of different reasons. But we'll definitely try and make it this year.
I think so, Al. Nice to see all the classic actors still getting to these conventions, the likes of the stalwarts.
It's always great fun.
Terry Malloy now, Katie Manning, Sylvester McCoy.
But it would be nice if more of the more recent people did more English things than they do American. We all know what that is.
Well, I think Stephen Moffat stirred up some controversy, or at least he answered some of his critics at Gallifrey One a few weeks back. From what I've heard, there's no recordings allowed of those panels, so we won't see them on YouTube, folks. But the feedback from social media was he really batted back well some of the criticism of his era, that perhaps he didn't write females well enough. Other issues as well.
Yeah, but I think that doesn't really stand up, because the whole theory, what, you wouldn't have Jodie without Missy, and he brought Missy in, so it's sort of, I don't think that argument ever stands up, really.
I think it sort of came back to the whole issue of Amy in Series 1 and that whole... I found it quite a strange issue of how she managed to fancy the Doctor so much, because she had... You know, she really did try to sort of get it on with him the night before her wedding, didn't she, in that one story. I think it all stems back from that, this criticism.
Well, a little bit. You know, I can sort of see where they're coming from that episode, but I think the way what Karen Gillan played it was brilliant, you know, and sort of it overcame it. It sort of, you know... Wedding night jitters, really, is the best way of describing it.
I mean, there's that whole side issue of whether us as men criticising it, we don't see the way women are written in the way that women do, Al.
I suppose, yeah, that is that point. It's like, you know, there's the whole debate going on at the moment, isn't there? And I expect when I watch the Oscars on Sunday, there's going to be an awful lot of interesting stuff related to women politics there, I think, this year.
I think so, Al, and just keep... treating people as well as we can, folks. You know, I know people of all sexes, all sexualities, all genders. Some are very nice. Some I don't get on with, and that's purely a personality thing, Al, you know, regardless of who you are.
That's how I've always looked at it. It's nothing to do with gender or whatever you are. It's always, if you get on with somebody, you get on with them. If you don't, just tell them to go away, basically.
Pretty much, Al. Pretty much. And a new release for us next time, a William Hartnell story just released a day ago as we record this one in the UK. The Ark, looking forward to that one. I think I've seen the TV story once. Interesting TARDIS crew, Maureen O'Brien and Peter Purvis, who reads this new novelisation.
Yeah, I was having a look at the blurb on Audible earlier, and it does look a very interesting sort of situation, sort of creationism and sort of, you know, viruses and all. It does look, sounds very good. Is there a DVD of it, or is it one of what's been lost?
No, it's a DVD. All the episodes, exist of this one.
Definitely. I was having a look at, as I said, at the blurb on Audible, and it sounds a very interesting one from that period.
And are you going to be buying the Enemy of the World DVD, Al, with the new extras?
I'm still thinking about it because, like, I didn't actually buy it in physical form when it came out for last time. I got it off iTunes.
Yeah, so, same here.
So I might treat myself to it just to see if there's any improvements.
I am trying to cut down on buying discs now. I've thrown away a lot of the boxes that discs came in, and I've kept them on the spindles that you get on the old DVD-Rs.
Oh, yeah.
So I keep those, and I keep a lot of the covers within sort of Polly Pockets just to keep them clean in case I ever get them signed. And I keep about 4 or 5 boxes in case I ever need some for a display or want to put them in a box. So,
I try and cut down on the DVD button because I buy most stuff on 4K Ultra now, so it sort of swings and roundabouts, really. The Ark, written by Paul Erickson, and the audiobook read by Peter Purvis. And of course, you can contact us on our Twitter page, which is DW Target Files. And of course, search for us on Facebook and leave us your comments and feedback. Let us know what you want from the podcast and anything we can change. Well, thanks for listening.
Doctor Who Target Files, The Brain of Morbius Review, featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. I Am the Doctor, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version for the podcast by Veil Mystery. Please do check out their YouTube channel of the same name, VAYLE Mystery. Newsround, opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, The Brain of Morbius Review was recorded in Swansea, Wales, UK and Exeter, Devon, England, UK during March 2018.